Welcome to VarmBlog, where our aim is to give you the best in analysis in philosophy, political economy, history, art, culture, and geopolitics from a left-wing and socialist-friendly perspective. We aim to bring you different perspectives from different walks of life and to have you educate yourself what to do with what you learned here. We do not aim to give you prefabricated and easy answers. Abandon all hope, ye who subscribe here, for you will learn, and it will be your responsibility what you do. And with that, let's begin today's episode. Hey, welcome to VarmBlog, and today we're with Kenzo Shibata, and we're talking punk, particularly late 80s, early 90s, maybe into the aughts punk, because Kenzo and I are both kind of old.
Mm-hmm.
I think you and I are both in that weird, quasi-generation between Gen X and millennial.
Yeah, definitely, like, my early, you know, not just punk, but, like, a lot of the just creative people that I looked up to were probably Generation X. Even though I'm 42, so I'm like at the cusp.
Yeah, so you are on the Gen X side of that. I am dead center. I'm 40, and okay. Then like 38 would be the bottom end, because I know 30 people who are 38 who like die on the like I'm a Gen Xer platform. I always found it interesting though, because I really did feel divided on these like weird, stupid generational loyalty test, because mm-hmm. I'm like, well, I remember the internet, but like, I don't know. Actually, when I think about millennials in particular, their internet and their pop culture actually has like more distinct phases in it than I think mine did.
Mm-hmm.
Cause by the time you get to like web 2.0, I am already well an adult. Like, you know, I'm 28 before the first smartphone is readily available.
Yeah. So, like, for me, Facebook was like, I had a few friends that started college late. And like, I remember mm-hmm. it started in the Ivies and then some of the other schools out East. If you had like an email address, you could do that. And so like, it's weird because it's considered such a boomer thing now, but when it first came out, I almost thought I was too old for it. Like, you know, this is something that college kids can get into. Like, they're using it to hook up with each other. Like I got my own world to live in.
Yeah, when I got on Facebook, I was a college, I was a TA in grad school, and I used it to keep track of my students' names, which I would never in a million years do now. Mm-hmm. And they would friend me. It was very weird. Like the etiquette and the social norms around it were completely unstated.
I mean, one thing I like about it now, though, is former students of mine, like, and they all like know the good boundaries around it, like year or two after they graduate, like,
right.
Like, you know, they'll friend me and like, we'll be able to check up on each other. So like, I just keep one, but I don't fuck around on Facebook.
Yeah. My oldest students are 30 on and their only access to me is through Facebook, which is kind of interesting. For people who don't know, both Kenzo and I are teachers. I'm an academic who left deliberately and became a teacher in my late 20s. But you and I also come out of the punk scene, and yeah. It came out on our friend Forrest's movie night extravaganza how much time period that we overlapped. My writing career, in so much that I have one beyond poetry, began as a music critic when I was 14 years old, writing for zines. I did my own from 1994 to like 1998, where we just literally stole copies from one of my friend's mom's work. And then when the internet happened, we took advantage of that. But I do remember, you know, I learned to interviewing local bands. And I came out of the ghost of Capricorn Records around Macon, Georgia. Okay. So like what they still had at that time was like 311.
Okay.
And stuff like that. Like, so, So the music scene in Macon, you know, historically has been super important, but it was already pretty well dead by the late 90s. But I remember how hard it was to get music. Like, mm-hmm. And you felt differently about even fairly mainstream music, like, than I do now. I mean, in one hand, culture has become hyper homogenized, like literally, like you can map out popular songs and they have the exact same musical DNA. Mm-hmm. And on another hand, like musical subcultures have such a low barrier of entry, which is basically just finding it on the internet, that they don't, like, kids don't identify with it in the same way.
Yeah, I was thinking about this like a couple nights ago. I was streaming the documentary Beyond the Screams, which, mm-hmm. by the way, is free on YouTube. It's 25 minutes long. It's directed by Martin Crudo, who led the band Los Crudos. And I found out about that band, and that band actually was one of the first catalysts that pushed me into activism totally by chance. I was at a show out in the suburbs at a youth center. I was like 14, and some guy, I don't know if he like ran a distro or something, he just dropped a big box of 7 inches on a table and said, "Hey, these are free." So me being the good socialist I was, I didn't just take all of them. I took, you know, one of each. And one of them was Los Crudos, and it was a split 7-inch with Huasipungo, which is a another Latino punk band that was really just driven by their politics. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later I realized that, like, these weren't even really punk kids. These were activists who saw such potential in the hardcore scene for spreading their message, for organizing, that they just kind of ran with it. And they made some incredible music because of it. And like, I was thinking about their old shows, and I would go to these shows in these like rapidly gentrifying neighborhoods that the other, you know, more white bands weren't playing at. And, you know, you'd go there and afterwards you'd be like, "Oh, I really love the lyrics in that one song." And they'll be like, "Okay, here." And they'd hand you a flyer to show up to like a protest, you know, protesting, you know, an evil developer coming in their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So I was getting immediate political education from something that was kind of just something by chance, because I happened to be at a punk show that day.
You know, my political radicalization and de-radicalization actually is similar. I would, I was into zine culture, as I mentioned, in the mid-90s, and I would say by my standards now, a lot of the politics of zines are a little bit ridiculous, but I do remember, for example, being really passionate in ninth grade about Mumia Abdul-Jamal.
Yes.
And I got that way from reading an article in a zine that I think I found through somebody downstream from Rage Against the Machine, actually. So this wasn't even like super obscure yet. And I also remember the realization that bringing it to the black community where I lived in the Deep South, and them kind of laughing at me, is like, "Why is white boy interested in this? He probably did it." And I was like, "I don't understand." So that was my first like political reckoning as a kid. But I remember about the punk scene is politics were ubiquitous, but also extreme, and extreme in many directions. Like, it wasn't all. Like, I think anarchism was way more common than the Marxism, mm-hmm. or anything like that. You had people who were basically primitivist. I ended up in like in real life, I ended up in a gutter squat for a while. You know, dealing with a lot of that stuff, and that was really romanticized in that scene when I was in high school. And it was the punk scene that got me out to Seattle, but it was also interesting, as we were talking about off air, and as you implied here, so much of this punk stuff was based on, if you had the right zines and if you had the right distros, like, mm-hmm. so like the first like alternative records album, like that I got was like a Dinosaur Jr. album, which immediately looped me into SST. Like, because if you found an album or a cassette in like a normal music store, the way you got anything else was mail-in music distro.
And that was such a double-edged sword because mm-hmm. you'd get the catalog and you'd see bands that had cool names, cool album covers, and then you'd spend your, you know, entire allowance or whatever on that. And then you try to, even if you only like one song, you convince yourself, at least for me, I would convince myself the whole record was better until like a few years later. I'm like, no, this is actually crap. Now that everything's MP3s, I'm like, I can admit that, like, yeah, it wasn't all great.
You had you did have a lot of like prior investment syndrome with a lot of your scene because it was hard to get, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, and I think people don't, this had like downstream cultural effects, particularly on young people. And there was politics implied by what you picked. Like if you were in the hardcore scene, you tended to be left wing. If you were in the punk scene, you tended to be some kind of anarchist, but they could be kind of a right-wing anarchist, honestly. Yeah.
A lot of it was just anti-authoritarian.
Right.
So we could kind of go either way. So like, you know, the suburban kids that I knew, they could vibe with it because they hated their principal and they hated their mom and dad. And then, you know, the kids with more radical politics, they hated, you know, George Bush, I think at that time, or Clinton, probably more. Yeah, Clinton.
Yeah, we hated Clinton. I remember like my first political scene was a scene called Wouldn't Be Prudent. And it was out of like Syracuse, New York, actually, or something like that. And I had found them kind of accidentally. You remember Fact Sheet 5?
Yes.
Yeah, because this was also part of that culture. Like, you go in and you're like, okay, I'm going to send you, I'll send you stamp money and like a dollar in an envelope directly because, like, you know, I'm not getting a money order for a buck. And people would send you a zine back. And not only did I participate in that, like, I also sent zines out and it was like, yeah, send me a dollar or like three stamps. I'll give you, you know, I'll give you a zine. But the other was true, and there's a lot of zine trading, and that was weirdly like you could get connected to things all over the country, but you had to know where to look, like, and it wasn't easy. I do remember like towards the end of the 90s, there was like an internet database for it, and I remember even being on it, but I don't remember it helping much. Like occasionally you get like this weird letter from someone who found your address on the internet, but you'd have to know how to look for it and where to look for it. And you would be stuck in these milieus. Like, so like you get, you know, local bands would send me tapes. And so I had all these, some of them I wish I still had. I mean, unfortunately they were not tapes that tended to last, but I had all these tapes by bands that probably made 100 of them. And they would send you stuff. And so I kept doing zines because I didn't have money to buy records. They're like $20 a pop. By this time they're CDs, but if you did zines, you could get them for free or reduced price. So,
or like, I went the street team route when I had a period where I was really into Victory Records when they were a hardcore label. And I mean, this was kind of one of the early organizing lessons I had. I had to go out to record stores and talk to the people who work there about like what people are talking about and then suggest they carry more Victory stock. I go to shows and hand out tapes and talk to people, hand out flyers, and then I get free records and I go to shows for free. So that was another route to go.
Yeah, the free shows was also a good benefit, and getting to meet the bands a lot of the time.
Yeah,
although it was also a good way to get hit by a chair. I lost 2 35mm cameras because of chair incidents at shows
and getting puked on. That's happened to me
multiple times. You know, when I started zines, I was only going to all ages shows, but later on it was like, yep, I'm getting vomited on. My shoes are getting vomited on.
Do you remember the Lumpin' Times?
Yeah, I do.
So that came out of Chicago. And the Edmar Lumpin, the publisher, like to talk about how like the politics were kind of loose, and kind of anarcho, you know, nothing.
What anarcho whateverism is what it kind of felt like.
So he's kind of an ANCAP now. Like he actually was trying to push for a charter school in his neighborhood. He like wants to, and he's done some really cool creative projects in Bridgeport, where, you know, art installations and things of that nature, concerts. But like he kind of wants Bridgeport to be this little capitalist punk utopia. Artist utopia, and is actually local DSA right now, has butted heads with him a few times. It's kind of fun to watch.
Well, I was reading recently, or somebody was contacting me about the founder of SST, who apparently wrote a book that's like half reactionary. But that doesn't surprise me, actually. The ethos, and I'm a person who'll defend why Gen X is this way, because I think there's a tendency on the left to pretend like generations don't matter, but there actually is massive wealth and income differences between generations. Gen X was the first generation to not get shit, but they also came out of they saw Fordism fail.
Mm-hmm.
They saw neoliberalism kind of also, well, not fail, but really enrich people. They saw the Soviet Union fail. They saw, like, the revolutions of the 70s were mostly reactionary, if we're honest. I mean, except for in the Third World. They saw the Third World regimes kind of go capitalist. Like, if you were politically engaged, it was hard not to be super cynical by 1989. Mm-hmm. I think we underestimate how, like, because in my childhood, it was, there was this background of Tiananmen Square and the Berlin Wall are in the back of your mind the entire time. And also, like, when you start high school and when you end high school, all the maps are different.
Yeah.
And that's something that's, I think, right. People like millennials don't really. Well, I say millennials, like kids today, because I'm almost a millennial myself. But like that profound shift in the world is not the same for them. Like, their shifts are mostly the after effects of like 9/11, the rebuilding of institutions, the acceleration of the 40-year counter-revolution or whatever. Mm-hmm. The revitalization of Marxism in the early aughts. Like, I can remember the Marxist bands were really rare in the activist circles. That they did exist, but they were very rare
and marginalized in some.
Yeah, highly marginalized, and actually marginalized.
They had like one track or something that really pushed them out there. Like, people did not want to book them. My experience. Right.
And they had a double problem too, because not only did they get marginalized by the punk scene, they also got marginalized by Marxists who thought that was unserious and petty bourgeois. So it was like, it was a very confusing time. I kind of came out of the goth straight edge scene, and goth politics were wild, like wild. They could be extremely left wing to extremely right wing. Kind of like black metal now. Like,
yeah, because like Liebach could kind of go either way. And
yeah, you don't even know with Liebach, right? Like,
yeah.
Sisters of Mercy could kind of sound left wing 1 minute and pretty right wing the next. I mean, like, for one benefit of this, I think, is I don't judge aesthetics off of political commitments. But conversely, I also don't do the opposite. I don't judge political commitments off of aesthetics. But one bad thing is, like, you had a lot of very disengaged music or pop. Like, if you came out of the high school punk scene, what your idea of politics was kind of ad hoc activism. Like, you had a bunch of causes, but there was no overall framework from which to approach these causes, in my experience. And I think it's interesting because I think that's true of punk, actually, in particular, going way back to before our times. Like, you think about, like, the New York punk scene and the London punk scene. Yeah, there are some far left bands, but there's also the Sex Pistols is all over the place politically. Like, we've already talked about that on Forrest's show.
Yeah, like the only anti-abortion punk song, Bodies, that I can think of.
Right.
It's not written by like a white power band.
But yeah, I also remember, like, when I was in the punk scene, like, having to make sure your oi was either I or Y, because it really mattered.
Mm-hmm.
And this seems so absurd now, but like, what was it? Oi was racist and oy was not.
Oy, because it's like the Jewish oi. That was,
yeah,
like,
because
it was ironic. But right. The oi was like, you were, you know, boots and braces racist guy.
Right. You were a screwdriver listener, right?
But later screwdriver. Like, I remember these mall skinheads that I grew up with, grew up around, I should say. They started out as sharps. Meanwhile, all they would do is they would go to a billiards hall to beat up Pantera, like little kid Pantera fans for being racist. Like that was what they did to, you know, be sharps. And then when they decided that wasn't edgy enough, but they didn't want to be Nazis, they became trads. And one of the things they did to signify that they were trads was they would listen to the first Screwdriver record because that was just straight oi, no racism, but they would still do it like in this edgelord sense of like, yeah, I like Screwdriver, but the first record.
Yeah, but only the one where they're not explicit white nationalists. Like,
yeah.
Right.
They're still pretty nationalistic, I believe, on that first record.
Right. Well, you know, I wrote this long essay in 2004, which I don't know if it's still on the internet, but where I talked about how like the politics of punk, particularly after 9/11, a lot of the people I knew in the punk scene, particularly the gutter punk scene, partly because they were in the drugs, if I'm completely honest, like a lot of them were kind of strung out on heroin, became really, really Christian reactionary. Like not even like a lot, like I knew people who got into like Father Seraphim Rose, like the Deaf to the World, Orthodox Christian movement. I knew people who became like very, very, like who were part of my music scene, who like in their 20s became hyper Pentecostal and were like burning their CDs in public. And this was even pretty late. This is like the early aughts. So we're not even in like
where,
the 90s.
Where was this? Where this was happening?
This was like in the Southeast. So this is in Georgia.
Okay. So I'm thinking because like a lot of your institutions were probably tied to the church.
Yep.
Like, cause here it was a little different, like specifically the skinheads. I don't care if they were racist or not. Almost all of them became rockabillies. And like they go to the rockabilly clubs. And so like they all found this very apolitical space where they can all hang out in and still like, you know, cosplay like it's the 60s.
Yeah, I remember that was also a thing where I was at. I mean, one of the things is after 9/11, a lot of people, and I think like we always talk about 9/11, but it was a weird moment of collective violence. And a lot of people like, because I knew people who were in the left punk scene who like became weirdly reactionary, if only for a brief period of time. And I was somewhat horrified. But I remember these scenes were very trad apocalyptic, and they would get into the church, but they were also, it was also still a rebellion against Southern culture, particularly if you went the Orthodox way. Right. So what you would see is like people getting really into Catholicism and Orthodoxy because it was a fuck you to their parents, but it was still, you were still part of a church. You were not taking that leap off. I do remember the huge growth of rockabilly in the aughts, and it was totally apolitical. But one thing I do remember in my town, which was a pretty racially tense town, rockabilly was not super white, actually. So it was apolitical, but it was also, you have a hard time being an ex skinhead and hanging out at some of the rockabilly clubs, at least in around Macon, because there was a fair amount of black people there, it was almost a class demarcator in the black community, actually. So it wasn't. The other thing is, like, a lot of people got into Dirty South music, like, because it's just ubiquitous where I lived. And so you would have people go to mostly black areas and mostly black shows. And I think the historical racial tensions made this regional scene play out differently. And one of the things we've been talking about, I guess, is how regional and local this all was, because it really was different from area to area.
Yeah, one of the things, at post 9/11, the Chicago hardcore scene got like ridiculously violent. And like, I was used to like, I got stitches in my head at a show once, but that was an accident. And like, I love telling that story because like literally everyone cleared out, the guy that did it, we were able to talk, it was an accident. All the bands came by to see if I was okay. Like it was a really good way of, you know, explaining the communal part of the punk scene. But then like 2000, the early aughts, it wasn't like that. It was like people were going in there to fight. crews started forming. A big one out of, I think, Boston, the FSU, Fuck Shit Up, or Friends Stand United, depending on if they're talking to the police or not. They crept into Chicago, and they were a straight edge crew that like sold heroin and shit like that. And
yeah, at that point, I remember that actually. And it was,
I'm
really
like,
strange.
I started going to raves at that point. You know, I was kind of a later adopter of that because, you know, I started to like dancing. I liked electronic music. I wanted to escape all the scariness in the world, I think, and not like go someplace that's more violent than the rest of the world. And there were more girls there. Bottom line, also.
Yeah, I was actually, see, I was more of a, I started going to jazz clubs. What happened to me? So I was also involved in the industrial metal scene. So I was both in both those scenes. And my best friend, who was female, got pulled into a pit once, and I went being stupid and chivalrous, but probably for her sake, smart. Mm-hmm. And body blocked someone coming at her, and I broke 3 ribs. And that was not fun. And so I suddenly discovered jazz. And I got really into that. And I think I also started appreciating like how much Black music was in my region and area, and how much I didn't really, yes, I knew about Otis Redding. Yes, I knew about Little Richard, who were both like making staples, but like, I really didn't know, you know, the music of the area once. And like CeeLo Green used to go through my area all the time and stuff. So I started like really investing and getting to know that, which to me actually ended up being politically kind of more important. People know that I leaned right in my early 20s, but I could never embrace any of the racist stuff because that's what's my community. And it was like, it was like totally like, you know, like 50-60% Black. So, and I do remember the one thing I would say about the punk scene in the 90s where I was at is that it was overwhelmingly white. It was not that there was no punks of color. There were, but there weren't a lot. And so, you know, my rebellion against my own teenage rebellion was to get really into like jazz, eventually start getting into like Southern rap, start just diversifying my musical taste. And I think that did a world of wonder. I also started appreciating the country culture, like the Southern country culture, a culture of country music before 1990, in my 20s. Whereas in my teens, I was because what I knew was like, country's even worse now, but like you talk about like the Brooks and Dunn type of country, which all the political content is stripped out unless it's reactionary. Like, you know, unless it's like Toby Keith, whereas you go back and I started getting into like the country of like the 60s and 70s, and it's totally working class, like politics in a way that, I don't feel like was actually that represented in punk. Punk seemed very suburban. And then the indie rock I listened to was very cerebral.
Yeah. I remember like, as far as punks as a high school clique, we were like probably the only diverse clique, and that we were also overwhelmingly white, but, you know, my school, it was a suburban high school. We're like, and I was actually from a community that didn't have a high school. So we got bussed into this kind of middle-class school and, very racially segregated. Like even when it came to like the athletes, the Black athletes had one table, the white athletes had another table, that weren't even near each other. It was that like that segregated. So it was kind of a fuck you. The fact that we did have, you know, some people of color that were, you know, kind of, you know, part of like me, like we were all part of it. But you know, I think like Martin Crudo, to go back to what he was saying, they wrote this song called We're That S Word Band. And it was because he was very well accepted in the punk scene because he would draw crowds essentially. Just like, you know, he had clout, as the streamers would say. And but behind his back or even around him, they'd be like, oh, you know, Los Crudos, they're that S band. And so they only wrote songs in Spanish, but they wrote this one song, We're That S Band, in English. And every line is about how, like, you know, we know you white punks talk behind our backs. You know, we know you talk shit about us. Fuck you. You know, it was very different than anything else. The kind of, you know, politics that were ruminating around, like, the white dominated end of the punk scene.
I think it was interesting because in Georgia, like, the musical scenes were pretty self-segregated. I remember people literally freaking out when a punk festival crossed over with Freaknik, and everybody was like, "Oh my god!"
Have you been to Freaknik?
Yeah, I mean, okay. Back in the day, and
like, I know that's not the topic, but I want to ask you about that sometime.
It was a weird experience because I remember not understanding why people were freaking out. And like, there was actually a pretty big age gap between who was freaking out and who wasn't, but it was very much a thing. And it's not to say that some of the racial tension wasn't there, because what some of the people were afraid of is the fact that there were bikers there and then there was Freaknik people there. And, you know, you never know what bikers, where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a fair fear that you didn't want to get caught in the middle of that, but some of it just felt very like reactionary, even to me at the time. So I'm like, why are we freaking out? Like, let's be honest, like this, the only place we can afford to play is in a black part of town anyway. So like you're already here. Like this is their neighborhood. Like, chill out. Like,
I remember, watching the media coverage, like all the tabloid shows would cover Freaknik as if it was just this, violent, you know, scary weekend that white people shouldn't be around. And then like later in life, meeting people that would attend Freaknik, and they're like, no, the media totally killed it for us, because that's when the police started coming out, when they started having these fabricated stories, they started focusing on some of the worst aspects of it. So that was really interesting, me having that revelation.
Well, the one person I ever knew who got shot at a show was not during Freaknik. It was during a fair. And it was a black friend of mine who got shot in a crossfire, I think between gangs. But like, no one actually really knows who shot him. But in general, I don't remember anyone getting shot during Freaknik in my area. I mean, because Freaknik started in Atlanta, but we were in Macon. We were like an hour and a half away, so it emanated out.
Weirdly, my family got into a really bad accident on our way to Florida, and we ended up in Macon for a few days. So,
oh, you know, my hometown.
Very short Macon, Georgia experience. I stayed at a dive hotel for a couple days, had some good biscuits, and then we were back on the road home.
Well, I would say the 90s is the last time I feel like Southern culture was actually fairly distinct from the rest of the country. I don't think it is anymore. I mean, I that's probably controversial to say, but like,
how do you mean that?
I grew up, we were very wary of people who weren't from the South. And you grew up under the idea of, yeah, you did. So, I mean, and in my generation, we're no longer dealing with people who are making excuses for slavery. So this is not what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But you have this idea of like the rest of the country has more money. They look down on us. They think we're all racist. They think we're all hicks. We are like 5 years behind them culturally a lot of the times for whatever reason. And so we just viewed them hostily, because anyone like, I remember particularly if someone was from fucking New York, you were just like, or California, you're just like, no, we don't deal with those people. Like, you know, shoot them. Like, if you get a chance, like, he actually did that. But that was the attitude. And I think it had to do with the fact that like economically we were super poor. Compared to the rest of the country, particularly in the 90s. and in the aughts. Like the community I live in, I mean, it's even worse now, actually. But the community I lived in was like 50-50. It became 60-40. It's 50-50 black, white. It became 60-40 because the well-off white people left. Mm-hmm. Brown and Williamson closed down. It was the only thing supporting the area. So there was like no real work. And the punk scene there was, and the goth scene and everything was very much with that in the background. Like we were all kind of broke. We were all envious of other areas, but we also like kind of hated them. In the aughts, I feel like that changed dramatically. For one, there was this influx of people from the Rust Belt. I mean, people forget this, but like if you were from a manufacturing area in the late 90s and it dried up when the car industry fell apart, you came to the South first because we were doing all the building of like prefab houses and shit. And they were opening up all the like, you like the Japanese car manufacturers were opening it down there because they weren't unionized. Mm-hmm. And so that changed a lot of the culture. And then like for like Southern culture, like in the aughts, I remember going to Pennsylvania and like people who were rural and right identify affecting a Southern accent. Like it wasn't, it's not their natural accent.
And some places in like Northern Illinois, Wisconsin, even like what's his name? That kid, Matthew Rittenhauer, you know, the kid, the little terrorist kid, he's from this region called Antioch, which is basically like, if you not only did white flight, but you did white flight times two, because mm-hmm. you didn't even want to be around white people that, you didn't even want to be around Asian people, pretty practically.
Right. You didn't want to be like, you didn't want to be around like well-off minorities and maybe not the richest white people.
Yeah. And like, that's where I've seen more Confederate flags there than I do in central Illinois, even.
Well, I mean, I will tell you before 2008, excuse me, Confederate flags were everywhere when I was a kid, but there was like weird plausible deniability that was a historical thing. But the first time I saw like the most Confederate flags I saw after they changed the Georgia flag to something else in 2000 was in Pennsylvania and Ohio. And I remember just going like, you guys don't have plausible deniability. Like I get someone from Georgia, like, trying to claim heritage, not hate, but what are you gonna claim? Mm-hmm. Like you're here. But then that came back home. Like it was weird because when I after Obama was elected, I do remember starting seeing Confederate flags again, which I had not seen since the 90s in mass. So it's a lot of, there's a lot of weird signaling there. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because it was a part of the scene, but I would say, I mean, like what part of the scene that you fell into was kind of a demarcator of class, and oddly, punk was actually kind of a lower middle to upper middle class phenomenon. Like, whereas like actual working class kids actually probably weren't that into punk in the 90s, if I'm completely honest.
Yeah, it wasn't that accessible. Like if you turned on the radio, you know, that music is accessible. Like you had to seek things out. You had to do mail order. You had to go to shows.
Right. You had to put a coat hanger from your boombox up your house to catch the college radio to listen to it. Like, which is what I did. But yeah.
Things are kind of flattened now because of the internet. So like, you know, some of those kids who didn't have access to more underground stuff like they do now. But yeah, also on the other hand, you know, we are subject to the algorithm now. And, you know, what you are, you know, being exposed to, unless you are seeking stuff out, it's kind of going to be the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, we're flattened by the algorithm and the music is written by algorithm, if we're completely honest. I know people get mad at me for saying this. I'm like, no, like people have perfected pop music to the point that you can literally construct it by an algorithm and a couple of auto-tune tracks and someone who's pretty. But it's also interesting how little resonance that has with my students. Like, we're both teachers. We both deal with a lot of young people. And yeah, they listen to Doja Cat and whatever's on, actually whatever's popular on TikTok, to be honest. But they also listen to a lot of old music and a lot of like 90s to 70s to even boomer music. Some of them weirdly have like boomer nostalgia in a way that I want to beat mm-hmm. out of them. But a lot of them also have 80s nostalgia. It's quite strange.
There's something going on in the metal scene where if you are outwardly like not necessarily right wing, but like nationalistic, you have a bigger chance at an audience because you're playing these huge stadium shows now. So like a band like Five Finger Death Punch, they're the troops' like favorite band, or Disturbed, or like, you know, they're still able to like do that. Even in the metal scene, like if you're just apolitical, you're playing small clubs again, or you're even playing bars. You're not selling a whole lot of records. So yeah, I mean, like that, and that's, you know, another of that, you see a lot of that Southern, effect, you know, affect in that scene as well. Just the right wing, join the army, like, you know, the power of the music is like the power of your machine gun kind of music.
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting because, I mean, even like Disturbed started out as a fairly apolitical band. Mm-hmm. I was talking to this yesterday, actually, about something completely different. I was actually talking about role-playing games. I'm like, if you want a niche audience but that is stupidly loyal, you can play the right-wing card pretty easily. Yeah. Because mainstream wokeness is actually just searching for expanding demographic pool. So, like, of course they are. Like, you know, just look at the birth rates. You can figure it out. But there is a sense in which these conservative bands just want someone who's super loyal. Where mm-hmm. if you're an apolitical band, your music loyalty has to be somewhat based on proficiency or whatever. But it's a weird divide in the metal scene, because I can also think of, like, for example, or even in the neo folk scene, which is traditional, like, which I'll admit I like neo folk, but that genre is tends to be like more white nationalist-y than yeah. even oi, right? Like, but being in there's this weird sense in which there's also some of the genres that are traditionally associated with right-wing politics, not so much mainstream metal, but like black metal or neo-folk, where there's an explicit pushback against that too. So like Wolves in the Throne Room make a big deal of supporting Black Lives Matter. King Dude makes a big deal of not touring with white nationalists. So it's interesting how this, like, there is an incentive to tie your politics into your music, even in music that doesn't have any political content. And I do find that a little strange. Mm-hmm. It's definitely if I'm honest, it's like a marketing phenomenon more than it is a sincere political phenomenon, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, if Varg came out of prison and decided not to be a Nazi anymore, like, there'd be no stock in wearing a Burzum shirt to your school.
That's true.
You know, he can't be normal. If he was normal, people would just kind of forget about him.
I mean, or he'd become Glenn Danzig or something, whose weirdness is just far beyond what we can yeah. comprehend politically.
Yeah. When Danzig was talking about cancel culture and people were like kind of roasting him, I'm like, it's Glenn fucking Danzig. I'm surprised he didn't put out a take like this 10 years ago. He's, you know, I love Danzig, but he's a douchebag. And mm-hmm. I've always accepted the fact that, you know, he's both a douchebag, and his douchebagness helps him make this campy, fun, dark music. And I think
right,
if
but
you
it makes
campy,
terrible movies. Like, I watched and it, like, hurt my soul.
movies
as a person who likes terrible movies, actually, but like, oh, God.
That's one of those bridge too far for a lot of creative people, is like when they attempt the movie, that's, you know, that's just too much. But when he did did you see his Elvis special?
Yes, actually, that was pretty interesting.
Cause that was so campy and like, you know, he pulled off, he could still sing. It was fun. It was entertaining.
It's interesting. Like, I mean, the Misfits are, you know, Misfits and Dagson is interesting. Cause that's that if you want to talk about the aestheticization of something,
yes.
How many people did you know in the 90s wear a Misfits shirt who had never fucking listened to a Misfits song? I think super common.
In the 90s, you couldn't get a hold of a lot of their stuff.
No, so you couldn't get it, but you could get their shirt. Hot Topic, exactly. Like,
so you'd find like maybe a bootleg here and there, so you knew a few Misfit songs, but like no one really knew the Misfits at all. But like, yeah, the shirt was definitely a hot one. And then when
Black
they resurrected,
Flag was similar, like nobody actually listened to early Black Flag. It was hard to find.
I mean, there are people Black with Black Flag tattoos who never listened to Black Flag,
right? I know, you were just like. Not to out my partner, but she was wearing a Black Flag shirt, and I was like, "Do you listen to Black Flag? And if so, what era?" Uh-huh. And she was like, "Don't pull that music nerd shit on me, Varn." but it was, you know, actually Black Flag's interesting though. I mean, you think about the punk scene; you have the British bands who are more political than the first wave of New York bands, but then you do have like the DC scene in particular, which is what develops in the hardcore, was always more explicitly and emo. I mean, by emo, we mean emo before 2004, but we mean like from Rites of Spring to Texas is the Reason. We don't mean anything beyond that. But it's, it was interesting how you could kind of tell where someone was if they were actually a fan of Black Flag and just weren't wearing a shirt because it was cool, or because there are other bands. I mean, like Steve Albini's bands were always weirdly political, but you could never really tell what politics was coming out of that.
Yeah, he's a strange man.
He's still a strange man.
I mean, I'm in Chicago, so I know a lot of people who've interacted with him, and I've never heard anyone having a positive interaction with him.
I have not interacted with him. I don't have that claim to fame, but
I haven't personally, and I never will because of stories I've heard.
I mean, it's funny because I think when we talk about this mail order scene, my three biggest mail order things that were kind of in the medium tier before like Matador and stuff really kind of took over and they ended up being bought by a major label anyway, was like SST, Discord, because Discord was cheap. Like you could get was always selling. Like when the average album was $20, you could buy a Discord album with shipping for $10.
Yeah. Even like their aesthetics, were like true aesthetics. Like they actually did sell shit for cheaper.
Right. And then I like Touch and Go because it was one of those things that was like a bridge. And then I was into like there was like all the local labels for us. I mean, Capricorn was in Macon, but there was also, what was the records? I mean, places that would do like 50 prints of a CD or 100 prints of a CD. And that was it. So that was an interesting time, and it was interesting. And I think I do some, like there's a double-edged sword with this regional stuff. Cause on one hand we had great bands who didn't know about each other. Mm-hmm. And even with scenes, like you had scenes that existed in the same city. Like we had a goth scene and a punk scene and a rap scene in the middle Georgia area. They did not overlap and didn't know what each other was doing. Like,
yeah, the only time, like in high school, I interacted with goths was like, you know, when you're in the actual walls of the high school, you kind of have to expand your circle a little bit. Like, I wasn't just hanging out with punks. Mm-hmm. So there were goths in our circle too. But like, yeah, I mean, on the weekends, we would all do different things. And, you know, we'd maybe have breakfast together in the cafeteria and talk about how much, you know, we hate plastic people. Like we had that, you know, we did the meme with the arms linked goths, punks, hating jocks or whatever. It was very different. And like occasionally, you know, they would come to a punk show or like, I, you know, would go to like a goth club. It just The funny thing about that was in when I was in high school going to a goth club, I just was in the corner like, this sucks. I hate this. And then when I was a little older, that was one of my favorite things to go. This club in Chicago called Neo, and they had a new wave night. And it was just hella fun. Like they play all the 80s stuff. They even go into like Nitzer Ebb and some of the more industrial shit. And just, you know, you just get drunk and dance like hell. But I wasn't ready for it in high school.
I think in Georgia, it was a little different because there wasn't enough of any one subculture to completely sustain itself, even though musically you were right. We went to different things. Mm-hmm. Although even in Atlanta, like the Masquerade had three levels, and one of which was a golf club, and one of which was like a mainstream rock club, and one of which played a lot of punk bands. It was a kind of strange scenario. But I remember, for example, we talk about these mail order things. Like I remember discovering all this industrial music through Meritor and then discovering Muslim Gauze and some of the really wild like clip music. And I didn't see it as that different from punk. So I just didn't have the same like aesthetic allegiance. But if I lived in a city, you would have, because there would have been enough people that would have been an identity demarcator. And I can get philosophical about why I don't think that's necessarily great. But I also think, if I'm honest, I think for a lot of people, what we've replaced these musical and aesthetic subcultures with is politics as a subculture. And not politics as like something you do for a broad group of people, but like something that you believe and belong to. And that's even true for some degree with my students, because like I don't see division. You know, like when I first started teaching, you would even still see divisions between like emos and everybody else, right? Talk about the emos, like in the late aughts, because when I first started teaching high school. But now, like, there is no clear demarcator like that. You can't look at a group and know, like, what music they're into, what probable social class they are.
Yeah, there are different level. Like, you know, I when I first returned to teaching in 2018, after taking a break and working for unions, walked up to a kid that I was just, you know, not really connecting with much, and he's wearing a Metallica shirt. So I'm like, oh, I was at that tour. I saw them on that tour, and he's like, I just like the design. I don't know this band.
Right. Yeah. That happened a lot.
Like, if you did that when we were teenagers, you would get roasted. Up. Yeah.
You got more than roasted. Like there would have been mild violence. Like,
yeah.
You know, it was, and I think that's, I mean, I actually don't necessarily think it's a bad thing that we don't have these like stupid subcultures off of arbitrary music choices. But I do think it's interesting how we've devalued a lot of this cultural experience, because I don't think kids seek a lot of this stuff out, also because there's no cost to doing so. Like I only meet kids who are really into like weird music when they, you know, when they feel particularly alienated by pop, which does happen a lot, but like that doesn't equate to a ready-made community in the way it kind of did for us, even if it was a superficial and dumb community.
Yeah. I noticed like with my students, the kids that are like the kind of metalheads or the punk kids that don't, you know, they're part of a subculture. Because some kids, you know, because it's so ubiquitous, like you could listen to metal and be part of whatever. But like the kids that are part of that, like they listen to the bands we listen to.
Yeah.
And like they actually love hearing stories about seeing shows and
no,
stuff
kids
like
will
that.
Talk to me about like about everything from like me growing up in the same town as Otis Redding to like when I met Peter Steele once at a diner in Macon, which is a true story, because he was playing, awesome. like Typo Negative was in that medium range of, we're doing a national tour, but we're playing every podunk-ass town on the East Coast. And so, I met Peter Steele before he drunk himself to death or whatever he ended up doing.
They were so interesting, too, because they were all New York City public workers. And
right.
Union
now,
members.
He was a nice guy, actually. Like even to, like... like 17-year-old me, he was unnecessarily gracious. And I was like, I think that giant guy over there with the black hair is Peter Steele. Like, which you wouldn't expect from, like, because they were, they were up and coming when they were doing that tour. Like they were about to kind of break out. Mm-hmm. I do remember the one thing I would say about metal versus punk is it's despite our inclinations by the 90s, punk felt way more suburban. So when I go to like, mm-hmm. I was in bands too. And when I go to like practice with some of the punk bands, I would go to like really what I considered in retrospect, they were not, I was just poor. Like I was just lower middle class, but what I considered rich neighborhoods, they were probably like 90K neighborhoods in 90s mm-hmm. money. And that's where all the punk like musicians were from. And when we did the metal shows, we were like in the, like, the what would now be called transitional neighborhoods because they were black white neighborhoods. They were not just white. And they were, that means they were working class. And so like, I remember like punk for me began to feel aspirational, which is really bizarre given its mm-hmm. history. And I don't know if that was regional or not. Like, I don't know if, because like, you know, Southern metal and has a history, like, in a way, you know, coming out of Southern rock, and punk was, there was, I mean, there's both black punk and Southern punk, but it wasn't like, that wasn't what was being sold. It was like, this was punk and like everybody's trying to be Operation Ivy mm-hmm. time period.
Yeah. In Chicago is a similar dynamic. Like the metal bands for the most part were from the South side of Chicago, even the white bands. Were part of like, you know, working class neighborhoods on the South side, and the punks all came from the suburbs for the most part. There was, you know, there was, because I was talking about that Latino punk scene, which was separate from like the white dominated punk scene. So yeah, I could see where you're saying that. And like a lot of the punk shows that were in the city, it was like, you know, kids from the suburbs going in. And like an interesting thing I was thinking about was that, like, so the Latino punk scene was really tied to activism. And when it fizzled out, it didn't really fizzle out so much because a lot of the people just went back into their communities and continued organizing and just stopped playing in bands because they like started families and whatnot. But then like the opportunities that come when you're part of that white, predominantly white punk scene, the band Fall Out Boy started out as, I mean, these guys were all in hardcore bands. In fact, Pete Wentz was in a Marxist band called Race Traitor. Mm-hmm. And for sure, I don't think he maybe wrote any of the lyrics he was on in kind of the end, but they were all hardcore guys. And as a joke, they made this band Fall Out Boy, which is supposed to be a punk boy band.
Right.
And the label, some major label caught wind of it. And like, because, you know, they weren't really accountable to anyone but themselves. They like, I don't care if people are going to call me a sellout. I'm going to go ahead and make some money. Whereas like if one of the bands from the South side, like one of those Latino punk bands like Los Crudos, they, you know, they had a lot of internal pressure to not do anything like that. And I think that is kind of why that scene fizzled out, was when things got too big. Even Los Crudos, when they got too big, the band broke up, and Martin Crudo said, well, how am I going to like make a splash in another one of his identities? He's gay. He's a gay man. And the scene was, it had a lot of homophobia in it that, you know, people didn't address because the lyrics of the songs were anti-homophobic.
I was about to say, there was so much. I mean, I even with bands that I don't think were particularly quote problematic, like I was listening to the Voodoo Glow Skulls. But there was so much like casual, just like, we just, you know, and I remember this, and I remember actually weirdly it being weird to me, but for a different reason. So people would just use gay to mean bad.
Yeah.
And that was super common in a lot of those punk lyrics and that scene. Even though I also remember like a lot of my first exposure to the queer people was in the punk scene and was in, mm-hmm. it was definitely in the goth scene. Like, oh my God. But I also remember it was harder to be a goth under 18 because so many of the golf clubs were also sex clubs. So like, mm-hmm. like they were not all ages shows most of the time, but I do remember that. And I remember it being very awkward for people, even people who were really into the scene. I mean, the other thing that people have to remember, God, I mean, like, in 2006, like the Republicans were still making good hay running like anti-gay marriage ads and stuff. I mean, like, I think our culture moving on queer issues is large. How fast that happened was largely forgotten. It'd be also interesting, like, to hear some of these people's take. Like, someone's mentioned in the chat, The Descendants. I'd love to hear their take on some of their own lyrics now.
Oh yeah.
Even mainstream, like, punk, like Green Day, like early albums had some just casual, like gay panic stuff in it. Like, you didn't even really know if they meant it or not, but it didn't really matter, I guess. So there was a lot of that.
Then there was the edgelord skate culture that,
oh god,
was,
yeah,
part of it too, because like they very obviously just were in it for the lulz, but because it was a scene where it's like, oh yeah, there's a lot of queer people in here, it's almost like, hey, you know, everyone's cool, I can use the other F word in this lyric or whatever, because everyone knows I'm not a homophobe. And then, you know, years later, I talked to a lot of my gay friends and a lot of my queer friends from that time. Like, yeah, I felt like shit. You know, they were talking about how they felt less like shit in the punk scene than they did out in the mainstream world. But like, they were still experiencing the same bullshit.
The other thing I would say is the punk scene was not particularly friendly to women. Even in the hardcore scene, which I do associate, like I always associate the hardcore scene with more quote progressive, or honestly, I would now call her anarcho-liberal politics. But like, I don't remember it feeling particularly like female friendly area. And oddly, some of the metal shows, for as much as machismo as they were, I actually remember more women being at them.
There was a thing with, like, I think, right, like, just not wanting Riot Girl to exist, like, in right. like, the more mainstream punk circles, that they wouldn't book any of those bands. And they would, you know, NOFX would always write songs about Kathleen Hanna, all those bands would. So, like, it was openly hostile to, like,
yeah, I mean, yeah, Riot Girl particularly, because you remember Riot Girl, even though it was clearly a punk move, it got more associated with grunge.
Yes.
Like, even though it wasn't at all, it was clearly punk and post-punk, like in its musical DNA. But that's where it could be marketed more safely, I suppose. I mean, there was a lot of that. I mean, you know, there's a certain kind of machismo. I mean, like, there were bands that pushed against it, both bad. Fugazi was really big on pushing against it, even though they were not. I mean, I've been to a Fugazi show back in the day, and they would yell at you if you tried to start a pit because of the shit that happened later on, I think.
Yeah.
The
problem with that, though, is like, I think the intention with Fugazi, they wanted that to become part of the culture. Like,
and it never,
you know,
did.
It never did. It became like, well, we know how to act at a Fugazi show. And, you know, you would wink and laugh about it, but then you would behave at a Fugazi show.
Yeah,
but
because you didn't want Ian McKay to yell at you. I mean,
yeah,
like, you didn't want to be famous for being the asshole on a bootleg album. but like, I mean, it you know, and honestly, to a certain degree, I actually don't totally understand the hostility towards the pit, because like, I don't remember getting that hurt in the pit until later. Mm-hmm. But it was. And it was at an industrial show. It wasn't at a punk show. But I do remember the crazy... I do remember, like, straight-edge hardcore people who would just... They were always seeming to look for a fight. Like,
yeah.
And it was interesting to me... I mean, we haven't talked that much about politics, but it is interesting to me because when I started getting into radical politics in the late 90s, and again, I didn't stay in radical politics. I want people to understand this, but like, I learned about like the Bob Black, Murray Bookchin debates from the punk scene because of the zines who would reprint that shit, like, or summarize it for you. And then it led me to look it up on the internet at the library and then follow it like weirdly, obsessively on like LiveJournal when that became a thing. So there was this, like, there was a gateway there. I also was exposed to both radical left and radical right politics very first when I was like 14 years old, because when I would go to the library, I signed up for a Rage Against the Machine email list. Mm-hmm. And there are like Ruby Ridge people who were and then there are like Marxist Leninists who were both Rage fans. And then that got diluted over time. But I remember like, you know, the Rage album that like you flipped on the back, and like that's the first time I was exposed to Angela Davis. Mm-hmm. It was on a stack of books, and like I remember like grabbing a Che Guevara book from Barnes and Nobles and saving up all my money that I earned like illegally working at a loading dock to buy this book, and I bought a Che Guevara book off of Rage stuff. So it was interesting, like. Where it, and I say that because the punk scene I was in, you didn't get that actually that much. Like even when people were talking about this stuff, they didn't tell you where to look it up. Mm-hmm. Like it was weirdly elitist in that way.
Yeah, one of the first actions I'd ever done was protesting a Klan rally, which like I was kind of, I think it was a flyer at a punk show that drew me there, and that was like the first time I had met. Newspaper salespeople, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And so I was never a member of the ISO, but I was a socialist worker subscriber for a long time from like my teenage years. So Mumia was in every issue in the 90s.
Right. Mumia and Leon Peltier was like those yeah. were the things that you heard about. I didn't so much read socialist worker, but like because I'm a big old nerd, like. I remember the alternative weeklies, which were very like, although at one point you could buy them in Barnes and Noble, which was weird.
Yeah.
But like alternative weeklies, which would like collect all the zines. And I discovered from that the ISR, like, so not even socialist worker, like the more up, mm-hmm. the more like weird, obscure highbrow, and became weirdly obsessed. Cause I was like, who talks good stuff about Lenin? Like,
the other paper that I subscribed to, and I'll, you know, this is me posting an L, was the Workers' Vanguard, the Spart paper. Because I didn't know what a Spart was when I was 15. And, you know,
you lived in a major city, though, because that would have been nowhere near even Atlanta in the 90s.
The first few issues, I'm like, okay, this looks pretty close to the Socialist Worker. And then when they're like defending very obscure, for no reason, weird little groups in the
taking
pages.
Edgelord stances on like the out near NAMBLA front or something, or NAMBLA. Oh my god, yes, I remember that.
I'm like, this is definitely not. I mean, I immediately thought this has to be a CIA kind of thing. Like that's where my mind immediately went.
The fact that I was my introduction to socialist politics was the SPUSA, but then after that, I was involved with a somewhat infamous group that is kind of sort of two generations down a post-Spart split, and it's at least in its own origin story. Although I've known different Sparts to contest that, but it was wild. I mean, I would say overwhelmingly. The politics I was introduced to were either ISO or they were very anarchist. Mm-hmm. When I encountered the anarchist politics in person, I thought it was very upper middle class, or I thought it was silly, to be honest. And it pushed me into more libertarian and paleo-conservative adjacent politics. And that's where I stayed for a few years. But I also remember just knowing how many people in my area like flipped from being like radical punks, who some of them would even like say they were Marxist, to like being like trad Orthodox Christians, or some of them just became Republicans. Mm-hmm. And like it felt like their politics were really, really thin, and it was like kind of disillusioning for me out of that scene, because I was like, oh these politics are just an aesthetic sense, they don't like mean this in a real way, which I don't think was fair for everybody actually, but I do think there was a whole lot of that in the late 90s. I remember also like in my part of the woods, this overlapped with a lot of weird culture, like we all like were really into like apocalypse culture and like those weird Feral House books and stuff like that. And those also range from like crypto Nazi to to left wing, like, and so there was just weird heady like anti-authoritarianism. It could go any direction. And I discovered this even going back into early punk, and like why are all these non-Nazi bands wearing swastikas in the UK? Like, what the hell is that about? And stuff like that. I mean, particularly the Sex Pistols, but it was a more general trend. I remember like just like when I was in my 20s going, these people are just confused. And it took me a long time to like really discover more politically coherent bands, even though I was into them. Like, I remember loving The Clash, but I didn't really understand The Clash politics until I was like probably into my 20s. Our Crash, Crass, which is whose politics I actually now find a little bit silly, but like I didn't really get what, or even a band like Chumbawamba, whose politics are wild. But you wouldn't know it from their music, actually, or at least the music that they're most known for, particularly in the United States. So I've always wondered, there's been a weird tension with me when I'm like, well, I kind of miss highly politicized music, but I also don't know that I think it's effective or if it leads to a very deep sort of politics. And I don't think that's just with the 80s and 90s punk bands. I mean, I also think it's true for the anti-war rock music, all the boomer music that was supposedly left-wing, et cetera, and so forth. And so what's your take on that? Like,
well, for me, like, my trajectory was kind of like, you know, I thought I was a Marxist, but I was, you know, in my like teenage punk years, probably more of an anarcho-liberal. And during the Bush years, I became a liberal for part of that, you know, for most of that, really. And that wasn't a hard, that wasn't a big shift for me, really. I just, you know, I dropped, you know, some of the aesthetics, you know, the anarcho aesthetics, and really just, you know, still expected pressuring the elites as being, you know, a gateway to change. And, you know, I think there, a lot of it was just the energy being sucked out of the left during the Bush years and being promised that, you know, being in coalition with the liberals was a good thing. And, you know, me also being young, thinking, okay, well, I might as well be a liberal. You know, support, even though I voted for Nader, I never flipped on Nader, but I did think like later on, like, okay, this is just not the route for us. Right. And in that time, you know, I could still listen to NOFX because, you know, their politics were very thin and just, we hate Bush. We're mad at the government, money for schools, not wars. You know, that very liberal, mindset. And, you know, I mean, really like, what pushed me back into radical politics was when I started teaching in the projects, and then, you know, just seeing materially all these, all the theory that I had read before, you know, actually had, you know, come to life. And like, I was seeing the direct connections between the institutions and capital. The punk scene wasn't enough to keep me involved in radical politics. And part of it is the fact that it is that posturing painted over liberalism at the end of the day.
I had a visceral distrust of liberalism. I associated it with suburban people. I associated it with people who would tell me, you know, one thing about race, and yet they would like send their kids to private schools and we're still gentrifying the area. And my immediate response to that was like, well, at least the conservatives are honest and not all of them are racist, I think. So like, I was also part of the conservative movement that hated Bush. Like, we hated the neoconservatives. But it was also more available to me. I mean, like, this is where the regional differences, I think, partly matter. When I got out of that phase, it was from teaching too. And it was dealing with the realities of racial politics and teaching, not being able to drop what I knew about, like, like the areas, like I taught and I went to a school, actually my first teaching school and the school I went to were the same school, that was like 50-50. And it was that way because it was a giant high school in a large district where for some reason we never had a private school, like the churches or whatever couldn't get one open. And mm-hmm. so, and we didn't have a charter school either. So it was a truly racially and economically diverse school. And the story's intentions for that, it made a lot of delusions that I had really go away really fast. Whereas my encounters with the punk politics or even with like the Battle for Seattle, frankly, was like, oh, these are a bunch of beautiful losers. Who cares? Like, mm-hmm. if I'm completely honest.
I mean, just the fact that Adbusters was so cringe kind of pushed me into liberalism, and I'm not even right. really joking.
No, I mean, that makes sense. The reason why I never could become a liberal in that sense, I mean, people might say I'm a liberal in some ways now, but like, was that I just remembered Clinton and Bush and feeling like Bush was just accelerating the same stuff I saw under Clinton. And then for about a year, I was like, okay, I'm going to help the Democrats, but I'm going to like Kucinich is a joke, but this Mike Gravel guy, like he like was about behind the Pentagon Papers. He's not like, you know, little Dennis who could St. Dennis the Mad. So I'm going to support this Gravel guy. And then, you know, I did. And then he jumps ship and tries to like make the libertarians left wing, which was hilarious. But because that was the year Bob Barr of all people won that nomination. Yeah. And so I was like, fine, I'll throw my weight behind Obama. And as soon as he picked his cabinet, I was like, I made a mistake. Like,
yeah, Arne
I
guess Duncan. This is
right. It, oh God. I knew Arne Duncan was going to be a problem. I knew like there were so many of it wasn't just that he picked so many Clintonistas, is that I knew enough about politics to know that he picked the right wing of the Clintonistas yeah. because he was afraid of backlash. And I was like, oh God, we're screwed. That was my response to that. And I sort of went out in the political wilderness and was like, you know, like a fire breathing weirdo Marxist for a long time. And Occupy happened, and then I wasn't so alone in the world. Like, you know, I talk about this, and it's true. If you like, if you can find early Diet Soap when I'm on it, or Partly Examined Life, or something, where like we're like one of two people talking about Marxism in the podcasting world at all. We weren't the only people. There's like Seeing Red Radio or something. There was some other things that are gone now. And then there's like some Pacifica shows that were also podcast. And then that was it. Mm-hmm. And then Occupy happened and it like changed overnight. Although weirdly, all the groups that I remember from that time period are mostly gone now, except for the PSO. Kasama Project collapsed, the ISO collapse, and everybody and nobody saw that coming. Like when it happened, we were like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. But it was also like, how do you guys survive for so long? And why were you so big for so long? Like, so it was interesting, but I think all of us who came to this world have to admit our first toe in was zine culture, was the kind of incoherent rebellion of like punk and industrial. And I do think to some degree, depending on what scene you fell into, because of the investment, you often got stuck not just with like investing in bands you really probably didn't like, but I really like this one band and we're into the distro, but also like there's politics that come with that. And I think it's interesting because in some ways it's almost a precursor to what we see now with social media, where everything's so available, but we're also hyper bought into our like an entire worldview. And in some cases that's not bad, but in some cases it leads to like delusional madness. Or in the case of some leftists, the inability to talk to people who aren't leftists. Because they just don't deal with it. They might in their daily life, but like, and the way they interact and invest their political identity, they don't deal with enough non-leftists to know how to like modulate how they talk.
That was, I mean, I think my period as a liberal, part of that was like, I was also getting involved in Chicago politics, mm-hmm. and like, there's one party in the city. So like, even though I wasn't intentionally a Democrat, like all of the events and all the candidates that I was working with were Democrats at that time. So like, when Obama was being touted around, when he was basically like, you know, gifted the Senate seat, and then we knew that, you know, he was going to get higher up, you know, somehow, like I was already suspicious of him. Like I was reading the Black Agenda report at that time.
Oh yeah, me too. Actually,
specifically because even though I was a liberal, is because they were speaking truth about the Obama neoliberal, like circles that he was running in, and including, you know, Arnie Duncan, Axelrod, but also like Bill Ayers. Like this guy was building up credibility in a lot of different streams. So a lot of us, like even if we were kind of part of that world, were skeptical of him because we saw that he was just in a hurry. Like he was trying to gather up all these clout, like Reverend Wright. Like when I first like found out that Reverend Wright was his minister, I'm like, okay, so maybe this guy does have some radical roots. And then later you see him throw him under the bus.
Right.
So like, I never trusted him. And so I reluctantly supported him at the very end, just because I thought John McCain and specifically Sarah Palin would be such a disaster. But I was never invested in Obama the way a lot of other liberals were.
No, I really
so like my left either. Turn wasn't hard either.
I remember feeling really, really sympathetic to Aaron MacGruber when he did all those Obama agnostic things in there. In like 2008, 2009 on Adult Swim, and like he got a lot of shit for mm-hmm. it. But it was also interesting because I feel like the love affair with Obama was already over for a lot of people by 2011. But then 2012 comes and like, oh my God, Romney. And that's, to me, that was the freak out I actually, in retrospect, don't really understand. But,
So around that era, that was when in Chicago we were building up for our first teacher strike in 25 years, mm-hmm. and people were trying to get in our ear about like, you can't do this now. This is going to mess up Obama's chances of being reelected. And like our answer was always like, in Chicago, you really think Mitt Romney is going to win Chicago? Like, no, this is going to make him look bad across the country. And we're like, the mainstream media does not cover strikes.
No, I mean, Occupy made him look bad across the country, if we're completely mm-hmm. honest. But like it was, I mean, it was an interesting time period for me because it was disillusioning in a lot of ways for, not that I had a lot of illusions to begin with, but there was a time period where I was like, well, maybe these liberals, maybe they're like, maybe they learned the lesson from the Iraq war and their stupid votes on that in the beginning. You know, maybe they'll listen to someone like John Edwards, like, you know, who tried to do the like economic populist thing before Bernie and was just, you know, I mean, he legitimately was a creep, but they also, I mean, it didn't, how thoroughly they got him erased was pretty interesting. Given how popular he was, and it was something else. And yeah, I mean, for me, it was when I learned that like, oh, these liberals aren't going to learn much from the past, mm-hmm. you know, forever. And also the other thing about me is I've never trusted Democrats because I came from Georgia, mm-hmm. and like the Democrats in Georgia were Sal Miller. They were people who were like, I'm a Democrat, but I'm going to go speak at the Republican National Convention. Like,
you remember that where he gets up there and they're like, the Democrats aren't going to arm the war. What are they going to arm us with, spitballs?
Yeah, I remember. I totally remember that. I mean, it's also weird because Georgia did have like fairly progressive education policies because of Sal Miller, but they were also kind of somewhat messed, like when you actually think about how they were funding, they were like using poor people's vices to pay for middle class people's education. But like, you know, we did have a tuition remission in the 90s in a lot of ways. So like, it was just weird. I just, you know, coming from the South, you like, you didn't trust them. I also didn't trust them because also, and like, where I was from, like the legislature of Georgia never really, like, they didn't have a whole period where a bunch of Republicans were voted in. They literally just changed, the same people just changed parties when, during like 2000 and during the 2000 election, like they just were like, oh, we're not Democrats anymore. We're now Republicans. Okay. And so I just didn't have the same connection with Democrats. Although if you lived in a southern city, even now, I mean, like it was, it's still Democrat dominated. You know, although it's also interesting now that I'm in a really conservative area, differently conservative than Georgia, but because like even the teachers union here is kind of Republican, it's just moderate. This Romney Republican versus Trumpist, basically, and they're like, we got to have all you Democrats like change parties to Republicans so we can. I'm like, I'm not doing that. I'm sorry. Like,
yeah, I worked, you know, a statewide union job and like central Southern Illinois, you know, we had Republicans, like good unionists, good union leaders, who would, you know, fight the boss, but like also liked Trump. And like, you know, I never had a hard time working with them because like they would, you know, they would doubt me a little bit because I was a guy from Chicago. We talk a little bit about unionism. They'd figure out, like, I know what I'm talking about. And then, you know, we just know not to talk about anything, you know, cultural or social.
Right. Well, I mean, the last time the like Mormon unions were militant, and I say Mormon because they were predominantly Mormon, they were still conservative. They were just, they did have a real class politics in the 80s. Like they pulled some militant strikes out here in the 80s, actually. And that's not true anymore. Even though they're more politically liberal than they were back then, it has to do, I think partly, if I'm honest, with how much of our union staff is not teachers. And I understand they can't be. I'm not an idealist on this, but like, it's so much of it's pack building, and trying to like, even when I go to like union meetings, it's like half of it's business and half of us begging us to donate more money to the pack. And I'm like, so we can give it to moderate Republicans and right-wing Democrats. Like that's hard for me to get passionate about.
Yeah. Our statewide, the Federation, Illinois Federation of Teachers, what I worked for because of that. And like the majority of our members were in Chicago or like the outlying area, but, because clout acts so differently within these state federations, a lot of the central and southern Illinois chapters that had fewer members held a lot of power in there too.
Yeah, that's true here too. Like the like Salt Lake Valley has like by far the most members, but like Park City or even some of the places where there's like five people can pull a whole lot of weight in the state level union, partly because they're pretty much equally represented regardless of the population or the union density of the area. That's not totally true, but it's not truly representative in any way either. And you know, I guess it's interesting to come out of the kind of idealist world of like punk politics where everything's about conviction and and identification to have to do this, like, because this is hard. And I'm, you know, and unfortunately I tell people you need to do union work, not because your union's going to lead to the revolution tomorrow, because I promise you it's not, actually. Like, it's just right now that's objectively not on the table. Even like with a political Bernie thing, it's not on the table right now. But you need to learn how to work with people, how to talk with people, how to like get people aligned on interest and not on ideological grounds. Like, you know, a left-wing program has a lot more purchase with people then you realize, particularly if you're willing to modulate how you talk, and I'm using modulate, would you never actually say this if I was talking to like some of these people, but like change how you're talking about it based on the temperament and the background of who you're talking to. And a lot of leftists really aren't terribly good at that. Like they don't know how to interact with people who aren't in the fairly narrow range of basically people they meet on the internet. And I think with cities, it's actually worse, because like if you're in New York or even in Chicago, you can find a huge group of people who basically believe what you do. And that can give you a very false sense of how ubiquitous your position actually is. When you actually go to a union meeting and you're dealing with people who are pretty, some of them are pretty radical as far as their union politics, and just realizing they don't share a lot of politics or assumptions with you. Like that's you like, realize how off you are.
That's a debate I get into a lot about Robert's Rules of Order. Like there are people in DSA who say it's alienating, but also I'm like, we also have to prepare ourselves for fights out in the real world. If you go to a union meeting and you don't know Robert's Rules of Order, it doesn't matter how well you, how well you might organize outside that building. They're going to leverage the ruling party is going to leverage that again. They're going to do it either way. And if you have no idea what you're talking about, you know, you can't say like, you know, I think that Robert's rules is patriarchal. They'll laugh you out the door. Even liberal unions would do that.
Oh, quickly. I mean, even ones that are fairly super concerned about like identity politics, they'd do that. I would even go further and just be like, it's actually the same debate I have with a lot of progressive educators, believe it or not. Like when I'm like, I'm going to teach code switching. I'm going to teach it as code switching. I'm going to validate people's innate ways of being, but I'm not going to not teach it, because if I don't teach it, they're going to be at a social disadvantage later on.
Yeah.
And I can teach it in a different way. I don't have to shame anybody. I don't have to like, but I need to admit that this is a problem. And there's people like, no, just don't do that. Like you don't need to script up. A prescriptive grammar. You can recognize their own speech. And I'm like, until they turn in a cover letter to a job that way, if to someone who's not in their immediate community, I really can't actually.
Yeah. I mean, my students love that. I mean, they appreciate it because they do feel so alienated, you know, going out into the workforce where a lot of PMC language is being foisted upon the working class. And it's, you know, they have to like there's a lot more like computer work. There's a lot more like, cause people are all on email, the fucking
trying
email
to teach
politics.
People who are not well off how to write a diversity statement. I mean, I'm serious about that because right now it's a shibboleth that's like, oh, they have good politics, but also they have the class clout to know the right words to use on this and not just say, I value all people. Cause people are like, oh, let's throw that away. I mean, and in this weird way, you can like HR can use this stuff in this way. And I don't say this to say that things like diversity aren't important, although it can be over-focused on. I say this to just point out that like the way this is used can be pernicious, and you really have to be aware, and you have to teach people how to negotiate this. Like, you know, if you're not from a good school, you know, a good university, I need to teach you how to write a statement of diversity that will get you, you know, a decent job. This is just something that we have to do. And also teaching that element of it can actually, I think, kind of inoculate people against the most reactionary politics, which is like, oh, the poor people are taking, you know, these great unwashed, unwhite hordes are taking what little bit of privilege that I may have had, and now I have nothing away. And I think like having a very depth way of dealing with this. And I also, when I teach code switching, I also teach class code switching, not just racial code switching. Like it's like, and it's explicit. Like when you're talking to someone from middle-class background, you're going to need to do these things. And this is how you know. And I will admit right now, this has kind of become a culture war issue where I'm at, as has social and emotional learning to stop suicide, which is where we're at. But so just guys, so you know, if you think if people are stopping at critical race theory, which actually no, which like it's one of these things that I find funny because I actually am a critic of actually existing in academia, you know, post-legal scholarship, critical race theory, as it is actually instated in like late Crenshaw and whatever. But like no one teaches that in high school. Nobody, even the most like SJW curriculum I have seen has not taught the actual substance of critical race theory, even if they quote Kimberly Crenshaw. Like, You know, they might do like the Peggy McClintock invisible knapsack essay. That's absolutely it. Like, and so I say this because this has all become weird fighting ground and in schools right now. We've moved from fighting about evolution to like fighting about pretty much everything else. Mm-hmm.
Actually, I gotta head out in a minute.
No problem.
You might get put my kids to sleep. I do want to continue this conversation. I've been having a lot of fun, but yeah, he has to go.
You know, I completely understand. It's late where you're at and kids come first. I'd like to thank Kenzo for coming on, even though we kind of moved from what we were talking about to talking about teaching stuff. I hope you guys enjoyed it. But I think the big lessons, what would you say the big lessons are from this conversation, Kenzo?
I mean, one of the big lessons is that any kind of movement that isn't tied to any material or any tied to organizing is largely just aesthetics and can morph into liberalism or other shit.
I would totally agree with that. Have a good night and hope your kid sleeps well.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, Derek.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you for supporting VarmBlog. If you would like more, you can find our stream on YouTube under my name, C. Derek Varm. You can also find us on Patreon, where you can subscribe for early audio access, additional shows, unexpurged audios, Q&As with me on video, and other perks, such as access to our archives, etc. There are 3 levels of support. 1 level even gets you on Patreon shows. Occasionally here you will hear shows done with other creators. I hope you enjoy them. We'd like to thank our producer, Paul Channel Strip, and Bitter Lake and Jason Miles for making our intro and exit music. And thank you for all you do. If you can't support us financially, you can support us by leaving a review on iTunes or your pod catcher of choice. Have a great evening.